Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Does marriage work anymore? Not really, decided comedian Sandra Singh Lowe. Not for her, and a lot of women like her. Too much work, not enough passion. She's getting divorced and has written a big essay on marriage, Let's Call the Whole Thing Off. Her friend, essayist Caitlin Flanagan, is going just the other way. Her recent big essay says marriage is in trouble and must be saved. This hour, On Point, two old friends on American marriage. You can join the conversation. Is marriage over the hill? Too much work, especially for women? Or more important than ever? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Pasadena, California, Sandra Singh Lowe. She's a writer, comedian, and regular contributor to The Atlantic. She's the author of Mother on Fire, and If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home Right Now. Her big essay on marriage and divorce, Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, appears in the current issue of The Atlantic. Sandra Singh Lowe, thank you very much for joining us.
Well, hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And with us from Los Angeles is Caitlin Flanagan, essayist, social critic, writer for Time magazine. She wrote the cover story, Is There Hope for the American Marriage, for Time's July 2nd issue. Her most recent book is To Hell With All That, Loving and Loathing Our Inner Housewife. Caitlin Flanagan, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Hi, Sandra.
Hi, Caitlin.
And just for starters, to be clear, you guys are friends, buddies. I mean, this is not the first time you've talked about this kind of thing.
Oh, heavens no. No, we talk, we email, yes.
I don't think we've talked about anything but this subject.
Okay, we can't wait to dive in. I mean, Caitlin, your essay in Time was kind of sparked off by all the politicians who were stepping out on their wives. And your response to that, Sandra, your essay came out of very personal experience and in conversations with friends of yours. But tell us your story first. You had an affair, you're getting divorced, and it's not just personal in that way. You're saying you're really having second thoughts about the whole institution for a woman in your situation.
Well, I'd been in a partnership for 20 years with a very good man, and we had children. I wasn't a person who ever wanted to have children. He wanted to, and then I did, and then I love my children. But I came to motherhood and housekeeping and that sort of thing in an odd. I had always been, you know, a writer and an art person, and so it was kind of a new and awkward fit for me in a way. And then he would be on the road for 20 weeks a year working because he's a musician, and that was fine. And so I was at home, kind of single parenting. And then I realized yes, and then kind of like I say at the very end of the 20-year of our 20-year partnership, yes, my commitment to monogamy became unglued, and for someone I'd known a long time, and I just told the truth about it, and now we're getting divorced. And what I found is, you know, we had all these therapy sessions, like I said in my piece. It's kind of like I can co-parent, I can co-work, I can pay the bills, I can do the mortgage, I can empty the cat box, I can do this and that and all these other things over 20 years. But I cannot keep the spark going of date night. And I think that's one of the things that women particularly face. We have all these different roles we fit today into what we think, you know, marriage, wife, motherhood, home repair, et cetera. And then on top of that, after 20 years in, you know, the Oprah magazine version is then put on the negligee, put on the candles once a night, and then have your date night and get the spark back. And if you can't keep that romantic spark in it, you feel like a failure. And I think all I wanted to say in my piece, because once this started happening, all these people came to me and told me the stories of what was going on in their marriages. It's like, it's biologically, you know, it's not a natural thing for humans to stay partnered over, you know, decades. Our life expectancy was 47, now it's 77. To expect that you can keep the spark alive, it is one thing to work together and provide a stable home for your kids and pay the mortgage. And also, you know, with home prices as they are today, it's almost you need these companionate marriages to even own property, unless you do it in a more tribal way. So all that stuff is one thing. But then that romantic ideal to keep that alive, that is something we seem to be hanging on to from the 50s or beyond.
Caitlin, you know Sandra's personal story, but she's making a bigger case here, and she's saying, you know, this just isn't working for some people, her and some of her pals anymore, maybe for a lot of women. It's just not working. It's sort of bloodless, you know, no passion, women carrying too much of the load. You know, she says, why do we still insist on marriage? You were writing not in response to Sandra, but in response to, you know, various governors and politicians who had been stepping out, that we need it more than ever. What's your take, Caitlin?
Well, I think, you know, what Sandra's just speaking about now, which is, you know, sort of this reality about marriage that everybody happily married or not, you know, divorced or contemplating divorce sort of faces at a certain point, which is that you build up with your partner, you know, you fall in love and it's just so exciting and romantic, and then slowly you build up a life with so many complicated moving parts to it that when that first spark of passion was born, you probably could never imagine the cat box and the plumbing and,
right.
and all of that.
Right.
And I can, you know, I really remember being a little girl. My parents were classic sort of Greatest Generation people and married young and were married forever. And my father was Irish-American, and he had this expression where he was talking about something in the past, you know, before I was born.
Mm-hmm.
And he'd say, oh, this happened before you were a glimmer in your father's eye. And I always thought that that glimmer was me being a little baby that he would see. And then I got older and I realized, oh, the glimmer was sort of looking at my mother and having that initial glimmer that, you know, let's go upstairs.
Hey,
you know,
yeah.
You realize that everything, it is almost unbelievable if you stand back and look at it, that everything about housekeeping and household life and parenting really devolves from that spark. And that spark may not, you know, become a great conflagration, but it certainly has started this whole life that children depend on. And so that's kind of the great moral question that we ask ourselves about marriage.
So you mean when the spark goes, if the spark goes, is there still a reason for marriage? What's your answer to that? It went for Sandra.
And I think also with children, I mean, I certainly was in, my parents were, you know, they fought all the time. They slept on opposite sides of the house.
Ow.
And they got divorced. And certainly when I was a child, I was just praying that they would get divorced or my father would explode into flames. I mean, some children of really unhappy marriages, you know, I often if you ask us, we'd rather grow up in one household with one parent without just the fighting that was constantly, you know, there. So I think, I think Caitlin and I both referred to the same book, the Chirlin, the Marriage Go Round, a fascinating book on marriage. And,
Andrew,
you know,
Chirlin's,
I, we have
book,
this,
yeah.
Chirlin's, yes. And we have the idea of the nuclear family of the father and the mother and the children. But, you know, it's kind of like, if that's, of course, the best two biological parents, as long as they're not tearing each other into bits. But if there's one biological parent and it's still a steady household, and I think there's also a case for, and you know, Caitlin makes this distinction too in her piece, between middle class families and poor families that have almost a different demographic. You know, poor families are they tend to break apart a lot more, and middle class ones don't. If you know, if you're economically stable and can make a stable household, that's a good thing. And in my case, because I'm a professional woman, a career woman, I
yeah.
make my own income and enough to pay household bills. Then that kind of puts me in a different conundrum today, because I don't have the traditional dad that is working and supporting us. If I support my kids and I'm single parenting, if my husband's on the road all that time, then that is a different question.
So you're out of there. But Caitlin, I mean, Sandra added all that up and said, end of passion and all the other factors we've heard. I'm out of here. She's out of it. You look at that, and as I read you anyway, maybe I misread, but as I read you, you're saying if the passion begins to ebb a little bit, you've still got something very important in the institution, in the relationship, in the mutual support of marriage. I read you saying, stick with it, even if it's, you know, not a forest fire of romance.
Well, a forest fire of romance. Well, you know, a statistic is a snapshot of a large population of people. It's not a portrait of any one person. So a lot of times when you talk about what sociologists have learned about marriage, you know, we can look at any of our friends and say, well, that's not true of that person. And obviously I know Sandra well, and I know she's making good decisions for her life. We're friends. But when you look at large numbers of people, you find out that when you're raising children in a single-parent household, whether it's through divorce or whether it's because the parents never married, the children in large numbers do much more poorly than do the children from intact two-parent marriages. Now, there's a huge difference between how those effects play out in poor kids and in middle-class kids. You know, when you're talking about those devastating consequences of kids ending up in gangs and becoming criminals and pregnant as teenagers, that's this horrible effect that's happening in our underclass. And that's because in that population, women don't get married very often before having a child. They want to get married, but to them, getting married, that's the icing on the cake. You know, first they'll have a child, and then maybe they'll get their education finished, and then maybe they'll get some kind of better housing. And then when all that's together, they'll find a father, some father for these children. And that's just disastrous for them.
But it sounds like you understand Sandra, you know her well, but it sounds like in a way you're cutting her some slack here. In your article, you're saying, yes, it's bad if you're poor, but it's not good if you're middle class either. You say the fundamental question we have to ask at the beginning of this century is, what's the purpose of marriage? And you come down saying it's not just about personal satisfaction or pleasure. It's more than that.
I absolutely believe that that's true, that there's a larger purpose and function of marriage. And that when we're talking about what this institution is for, children have a great desire to know and be known by the two people whose physical union brought them here. That's why it was terrible in the days of adoption when we never told a child, you know, and it was a big dark secret, and a child might run across a piece of paper, and the adoptive parents ran off in tears, and you couldn't even find out if you had any history about yourself and illness and so forth. Kids really want to see, be known by, be loved by both parents, and they really need their fathers much more than they're getting time with their fathers. That's the two things that affect children through divorce is, number one, they get less money. Absolutely. You know, two can't live as cheaply as one, but two live much more cheaply together than they do apart, and setting up separate households and breaking up resources.
Yeah.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about love and marriage with comedian Sandra Singh Lowe and essayist, social critic Caitlin Flanagan. Sandra Singh Lowe just wrote Let's Call the Whole Thing Off for The Atlantic. She's had an affair and is getting divorced. Caitlin Flanagan has just written an impassioned defense of marriage for Time magazine. It has been quite a crazy scene out there on the political infidelity front lately. Here's a bunch of that. Mark Sanford here, admitting to infidelity in a press conference on June 23rd in Columbia, South Carolina.
I've been unfaithful to my wife. I developed a relationship with which started as a dear, dear friend from Argentina.
The governor of South Carolina there with a great big oops. In an interview with the Associated Press, his wife Jenny said she and her husband are trying to work things out. A lot needs to be done.
When I found out in January, obviously we both indicated a willingness to continue working on the marriage, but there's not room for three people in a marriage.
Three people, too many. Here's Nevada Senator Republican John Ensign on June 16th of this year admitting to an extramarital affair with a member of his campaign staff.
Last year, I had an affair. I violated the vows of my marriage. It's absolutely the worst thing that I've ever done in my life.
Another big oops, and here's John Edwards, the former South Carolina senator and Democratic presidential candidate, acknowledging his affair in an interview with ABC's Bob Woodruff, August 8, 2008.
In 2006, 2 years ago, I made a very serious mistake, a mistake that I am responsible for.
A lot of politicians in the hot seat there falling off the wagon. What's going on here? Sandra Singh Lowe, as your life was kind of, as your marriage was coming undone, all this stuff was in the headlines. Did it?
Yes.
Was it relevant to you in any way, or were you in a whole different...
I think it's absurd that we have to even hear about any of this stuff with these politicians. And I think with Sanford's marriage, it seemed like a 20-year, almost like a business partnership. She, you know, was a high-level professional woman, you know, quit that to run his campaign. 20 years, you see the photos of them at those dinners and the boys. I mean, they're just kind of like running a successful kind of corporation of two people in a family. It totally, and of course we all saw those emails that, you know, between him and the Argentinian.
The curve
and
of your body.
Yeah, and I have to say, you know, I actually know what he's talking about, and that's not stuff that we like to discuss of, you know, the passion, and God forbid, you know, any of our personal emails ever get out there like that. But, you know, I think that there's part of us when we're watching, we all know in the pit of our stomach what's actually going on here. You know, he loves this Argentinian person. He's going to try to crawl back to his family for the sake of his political career, and I think political marriages are the most, you know, of course, if you're on the campaign trail, or, you know, you're working those long hours, the wife's holding, you know, the kids down at home.
Yeah.
You have totally parallel tracks of lives, and different relationships are going to come up, or they may. You hope that people don't get hurt. You hope to not have it all dragged out publicly. Why we care about whether politicians are faithful to their wives of 20, 30 years, it's like, you know, why this is all public news and we have to keep going over it and going over it, it seems kind of absurd. And I think also with political marriages, I think of, like, you know, President Obama and the First Lady Obama. It is kind of we have kind of like these 50s nuclear ideas that we're thinking of these marriages should be. And I think for me, it's sad that Michelle Obama, who's brilliant and amazing and has her own career in her own right, all we talk now about is like her sleeveless dresses and her arms.
She's
been so first lady eyed eyes that somehow in our politicians we look for them to hold this really outdated ideal of 50s marriage, we all know is not a reality, particularly for them.
Caitlin, so Sandra says it's absurd we're even talking about the politicians. I mean, there's the personal, there's the political, but I mean, it led Time magazine to put this melting wedding cake on the cover with your essay right in the middle of it. It got a lot of people really thinking. It got you thinking about what people are looking for, pleasure or commitment.
Well, the question to me about, you know, Sandra's talking about the 50s, you know, role model, she's absolutely right. The question that I think the larger question I'm always asking myself is, why then are we so attracted to that? You know, we're rejecting it in a lot of ways. If you look at now, in the majority of American children are still being raised by their married parents. You know, they're the common children of a set of parents and they're still married. So we're not as far away from marriage as some of the more dire essays, you know, and statistics might suggest. But what is it? There's this very enduring thing across class, race, age, where that notion, there's something in us, we know enough to want it. There's something in us that thinks, oh, that's kind of magical. That's kind of alluring to us.
The Leave It to Beaver white picket fence.
Exactly. And, you know, the whole history of Leave It to Beaver, it wasn't a big success when it was on the air in the, you know, in its first run in the 50s. It, you know, got sold to another network and limped along for four seasons. It became the huge hit when it was an after-school thing you watched in the 70s when everyone's parents were their marriages were falling apart. So I think a larger question is, gee, there must be something in us that stirs and that recognizes, boy, if it could all work out, if the children could be at home with mom and dad, if that home could be a haven in a heartless world, if the four of us connected by law and by blood to one another, if we could all make this work, there must be something of worth there. I think there
but
is.
Also, I think with we, when you say we, I don't feel that at all. And when I didn't want to get married, and I was cohabiting 7 years in, and then we bought our second piece of property, we did. So you say we, but I don't think that's necessarily true for everyone. Certainly, there's a lot of societal pressure, and, you know, the weddings are such a giant industry. I mean, it keeps being hammered into us and certainly into women to be the princess to walk down the aisle. That's your special day. But, boy, that just doesn't sound really that appealing to me.
I
want my children to be blown apart. And I think that were I able to, it was my husband's decision immediately to divorce. I mean, we might have been able to work something out of living in the same household, just being friends, co-parenting, so our kids could see us. But it couldn't work like that. He just wanted me out, and I respect his decision.
I think what's interesting about you and your life is after the essay came out and some people who didn't know you were saying, how could Sandra possibly have done this? You know, she's the ideal mom we've read about. And I always said, you know, Sandra's this incredible performance artist, you know, bohemian, such a, you know, a cliche. But it's like I never saw you as someone, I mean, you adore your children and you're a great mom and you've gotten so involved in their lives and schooling and all that. But I have to totally agree with you that you were always somebody who was really on the edges of doing things in a really experimental, deep, artistic way.
And yet, in those
conversations, this life that you're building now is more authentic to who you are. But that's just my two cents.
I read that in her essay, but when she sat with her buddies, a lot of them had similar complaints. I want to get to that and to our listeners, if I may, and I'll let the political part go, but I just have to run one more. I can't resist it. This is 2004. This is then New Jersey Governor James McGreevy. Of course, he admitted to cheating on his wife with a man and announced he was stepping down. His wife, Dina Matos McGreevy, later told Oprah here, viewers, what her husband had said to her before they went out to make the announcement.
He said, "You have to be Jackie Kennedy today." And I'm thinking, Jackie Kennedy, her husband was murdered. You lied and cheated on me. And now I have to be Jackie Kennedy?
Oh, boy, talk about a challenge. Annie in Chicago. You're on the air, Annie.
Hi. I have a funny side note and then my point, I guess. But yeah. I have these friends who are wedding photographers, and they are booked to the hilt. And I always laugh about it and joke with them, and I say, I can't believe these young people are still doing this. And all of the parents at the weddings are separated and remarried, and, you know. But I guess the reason I feel that way, my parents divorced when I was seven. Horrendous relationship, very much disliked each other. The kids, there was five of the little ones in the house, always all kinds of tension and worry on our end, and you know, when are they going to fight next? And literally one day my mom sat me down and said, your dad is leaving, we're divorcing. And it was such a relief to me. And I said, even at 7 years old, I said, it's about time. You guys don't like each other. It's about time. And I felt such relief after that. And it was a different household. We were able to have a relationship with our mother who grew, you know, as a more fulfilled person.
So in your case, life got better off that, Annie. We'll pick that up. Let me get one more before we do from Barry, Vermont, and Chris. Chris, you're on the air.
Hi. I've been in a very happy marriage for 13 years.
Good for you.
I think a lot of today is people go into marriages thinking that oh well, if it doesn't work out, I'll just get a divorce. It's too easy for people, you know. My wife and I have had good times and bad times and struggled through accidents and money problems, and I made a vow to my wife that, you know, I would love her and respect her, and through better or for worse, and a lot of you know, today's view of marriage is so distorted by reality TV and what everybody else is doing. You know, people, you know, forget about what other people are doing, and
people like you who are making it work through thick and thin. Chris, we've got it. Sandra Singlow, let me come to you with those two, and maybe Chris first. I mean, you know, reading your descriptions of sitting around with some of your gal pals in, I don't know, Pasadena, L.A., whatever, and it seemed like all of them were just so unhappy with their marriages,
and they
were burned out, no sex, no passion. But Chris says, what about hanging in there? What about working on it?
These are women, and I'm 47, and I certainly, I've been at it 20 years. Mm. So, and I'm my husband's first, third wife, and I'm his. He's my first husband, mm-hmm. maybe last. So these are, and so women I know are in their 40s, and pretty much they're all in at least 20-year relationships. And the pattern for us was kind of 20s, you dated a lot of bad boys, that didn't work out. Then you meet your sensible guy, and you go, that's the one I'm settling down with. Mm. And then in your 30s, you know, you build a life together, and your 40s, now your kids are getting older, and you realize you've been 20 years in the same relationship. And he's sort of, well, he does the cooking, and he builds the shell, and he drives the kids around to school, and they're really, you know, the quality post-feminist husbands that everybody's ever wanted. Like, many of these women, like, have not had sex either recently or 4 years. That just has fallen off the table entirely.
You can't build shelves and have sex?
Apparently, no. You cannot. Our Cooks Illustrated Online, you cannot make a five-hour bouillabaisse for a man and also have sex. Apparently, you just can't. So it's kind of a deal that has occurred with them, and that some of the women are going, you know, maybe it's the water, that men have become so feminized or something, or, you know, they've had so much sexual harassment language thrown at them, they just don't want to bother anymore.
You were longing for, like, Islamic husbands.
Yeah, they are in Western Europe. They are, and it's an interesting flip of a time where we used to think of the man hitting 45, going through the midlife crisis, getting the toupee, and then the red Porsche, and then dating the 20-year-old blonde secretary. But now I see just kind of the opposite. That men have kind of worked out the good husband. You know, they've got their Cooks Illustrated, maybe their porn online somewhere that we don't see it. But these women are in their 40s. It's true that I'm among writer women and activist women. I've been active in the public schools. So they probably, my friends, this particular group, probably does burn with a flame that's a bit, you know, fiercer than perhaps other ones. And we talk a lot about this stuff. And there was just this feeling among all these women that they had the same kind of setups because they had married really nice men and good men.
Caitlin, what's going on there? They married these really nice men, and then they have sexless relationships that they're just bored out of their minds
20
with.
Years in.
Well, this is why Sandra's essay was so transgressive and so great. And I mean, what she said earlier on, she just told the truth about her life. And I think that's why, you know, more than some of the other things that are in that great essay. But she, with this great transgressive honesty, she said that, you know, maybe this completely, quote-unquote, egalitarian marriage, the post-feminist marriage, where the roles are divided in no way along gender lines, but they're divided just sort of equitably and by ever, you know, which person might have the better talent for cooking or for whatever, maybe you end up really vitiating the la différence between the man and the woman.
But it has to be John Wayne and Doris Day to have a marriage that goes on?
I'm not saying that, but I am, you know, I get teased all the time in the press, and I don't have nearly as much of a June Cleaver marriage at all as people would like to say that I have. But when I read Sandra's essay, I was like, well, maybe this is the key to my marriage. My husband can't boil water. I mean, it may be learned helplessness, but it's horrible. I mean, I have friends who won't come out over here to dinner unless they know I'm going to order out because I'm just that bad of a cook, but I'm better than my husband. So maybe this clinging to some... Just because, you know, I'm slightly more, you know, traditionally feminine than a lot of women I know, and he's slightly more traditionally masculine, maybe that has helped us.
Boy, I don't know.
Yeah, that sounds actually kind of hot to me. And the one thing that I would put in is that we live in an era now where kind of the Dr. Phil thing is like the best foreplay. Like if you want to have sex with your wife, the best foreplay is to unload the dishwasher.
Oh.
And I go, that is the saddest statement. That is the saddest statement that if the husband has to bend over and unload the dishwasher, maybe if he's wearing, you know, a French maid's outfit and heels, but it is the egalitarian stuff does kind of grind people down after a while where you can't find it. You're arguing over where the spatula
is placed. But part of the reason you're giving it up, Sandra, as you said, it's just become a bad deal for women, that it's the woman working all day and then unloading the dishwasher and everything else at night. You did the calculus.
Right. Nobody is the traditional, it used to be the traditional, the 50s husband. He worked all day, comes home at 6, the pipe, the slippers, the martini, and the roast. And then on the weekend, maybe run the lawn mower or do something. Now, as I wrote in my essay, the central marriage that I'm thinking of, where the woman is the traditional husband because she makes more of the money and for the health insurance, but she doesn't come home at 6 to get her pipe or slippers. She comes home to argue with her husband about who's cooking. She forgot to give the medication to the dog. He's accusing her of being a bad mother. She has no sex because he doesn't want to have sex with her. So she prowls around her kitchen at midnight eating Dove bars and gaining more weight that he accuses her of gaining.
Sounds like a raw deal.
And so it's like it's a horrible deal for the women. And then we also, it's kind of like to be a good mother, you have to do all these things. You know, our good mother, as opposed to the good father thing, our list is so much longer, and women are exhausted.
Can I testify to the other side?
You got 30 seconds before the break, Caitlin.
Okay, I just wanted to say that, you know, as Sandra knows, I've had some serious illness over the last 6 years. Mm-hmm. And if your marriage really works, it's just an incredibly great thing to have this life partner who's totally there for you and picks everything up that you can't do. And so if it is a match, it really can be just a great thing to be married.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about love and marriage with comedian Sandra Singlow and essayist, social critic Caitlin Flanagan. They've each just written big essays. Sandra for The Atlantic, Let's Call the Whole Thing Off, Has she had an affair? She's getting divorced. She's out of there. Caitlin Flanagan for Time Magazine. Cover story, Is There Hope for the American Marriage? You can read both essays. They're both terrific. Very honest in Sandra's case and very compelling in Caitlin's case at our website, onpointradio.org. Caitlin's the author of To Hell With All That, Loving and Loathing Our Inner Housewife. Sandra Singh Lowe's books include Mother on Fire and If You Lived Here, You'd Be Home by Now. Jessica in Pleasantville, New York. Sounds nice. Jessica, you're on the air.
Hi there. I guess I just wanted to comment that I sort of feel like maybe both views are, it could be a hybrid. It just depends on your own personal experience. And it's, you know, it is so personal. Yeah. I met my husband when I was 6 months out of college, you know, in my early 20s, and we're 15 years later, 9 years of marriage, 2 children. And all I can say is sometimes it can be really hard and sometimes it can just be absolutely wonderful. And there's an ebb and flow to marriage. And you know, I like what Caitlin said, that sometimes if it is a good match, it can just, there can be something so wonderful about it. And it's not to say that I know, oh, absolutely, for sure, we're going to be together, you know, for 50 years till the end of time. There's a vulnerability to every relationship where you can't predict how it's going to go. And sometimes, honestly, I'm quite amazed that I could meet someone when I was so young and 15 years later still feel something so wonderful with this person. And I recently saw a quote that really spoke to me that basically said that a successful marriage requires falling in love many times and always with the same person. And I do sort of feel like that's what marriage can be, is coming back to each other even when you've made a, you know, gone through a difficult period. And I can already say that, you know, I can, you know, specifically think of one particular year in our marriage that was already tough for us. And yet, you know, to now look back on that and realize how, you know, close I feel to this person and how important he is and how, you know, grateful I am to have this partnership, that it's just something that I treasure for what it is right now, and I hope it will be there till the end of time, but that I can't pretend that I know it will be, because, you know, it's always, it's two different people.
Right, so you're committed, you're in there, and you're realistic. Sandra Singh Lowe in Pasadena, as you listen to Jessica, what are you thinking? Watch out, girl, you're, you know,
no, I mean, I think that's a really honest, that's a really honest and you know, get in mindful assessment of what's going on. I hope that they will be together. I mean, I think for two people to keep working on something, I was just reflecting back to my own marriage. Again, my husband's a really good man, but if he's away 20-plus weeks a year. We're sort of like a military family. Mm. And musicians, they have to work. I mean, they have to work, and especially if they're brilliant and talented, I would not tell him, don't go on the road. And that's been true for 20 years. They just have to do that, and they have to work. Mm. And it just turned out for me, my intimacy, I like to be, you know, I like to have emotional intimacy and talk several times a day or see somebody on a daily basis, you know. And for us to set up a situation which was a successful marriage for both of our both careers, where he could go on the road, you know, for 3 to 5 weeks, then I could go on the road, and then I would take my children with me to hotel rooms, and that's kind of the way we always did it. So it was certainly an arrangement that was successful in that way. But I think what the, you know, our caller's talking about is a different thing, where you keep coming together and redefining, and both parties have to be able to do that in some way, so some path is open for them to do that.
Until and unless it just doesn't work. I mean, you have been very honest here.
Yeah, you can certainly grow apart where you don't have any hobbies that you can try to get hobbies you like together, conversations you like together, restaurants that you can try every single thing, and certainly I did that in my marriage, and we tried to do certain we did try and try and try to find stuff that we really enjoy together. And in the end, we're a little more different than we are alike. And
you're brave and you're honest. I mean, you've got the LA Times is describing for the world, you know, your possessions packed up by him in neatly labeled boxes, covered with a tarp and left stacked in the driveway. Ouch. John in Fort Myers.
He's a great packer. He's a Midwestern man. He has so many good things about him.
John in Fort Myers, Florida. You're on the air, John.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Well, it makes me sick to hear these two women talk about this. First of all,
why?
Caitlin, you sort of got it, and Sandra, I don't believe you have it at all. I've seen both spectrums. My sister was divorced 2 times, and myself, I've never been divorced. I've married for 2 years. I'm pretty young, but still. I've been married 2 years. And the way I see it is that, okay, the reason I say you sort of got it is you want to make it work for Caitlin. But Sandra, I don't know, maybe
20 years. Maybe 20 years.
Yeah, you're 2 years in, John, so it's hard to say.
We should talk in 20 years. But, and how old are you?
Well, that's okay. I'm in my 30s. But the point I'm making is that I think maybe Sandra has, excuse me for saying this, a jilted view of marriage. And I say that because I look at it from a religious point of view. I'm a Christian. And it says in the Bible, you know, that you're supposed to work this out and you're supposed to, you know, compatibility is a big issue. Yes, there are people who get married for the wrong reasons. But let's look at it from a historical point of view. It says that where marriage fails, society fails. And if our society if you look at the headlines, you see these politicians, you see everything, you see our society is in bad trouble right now.
But including a lot of conservative politicians, a lot of professed religious politicians.
So the Bible Belt states have more divorce than even the blue states do. That the church did not have.
But John, well, let's take John's point, the substance of it, though. First to you, Senator, then Caitlin. But he says, you know, where marriage fails, society fails. You hear the fear there. And Caitlin says something similar in her essay.
Well, it's true that in America, we marry and divorce at rates faster than anywhere on the globe. And that, you know, but I think the church-going thing is kind of interesting, too, because a church-going American, though, is more likely to divorce than a secular Swede. So that sometimes, you know, whether or not you, live your life by the Bible or do not, it doesn't necessarily and again, these politicians are often on the right.
But whatever you call it, the point, if marriage fails, society fails. Then you could believe that quite apart from any religious faith, if you liked. What do you think about that view?
Well, I mean, children, you know, we want children to have stable households so that they can grow. That's true. And the question is, and it's interesting because Americans then do remarry and remarry, which makes the households unstable. I mean, I think that's a really longer question to look at of whether it's nuclear families. I think that America is failing because we live so insularly. And I think some of the marriages that I've seen where we grow up in, you know, away from our family, away from relatives. So it's often left that the mother is sitting alone in the home with a babe with no support system, no network. People are afraid to talk to their neighbors. Kids don't run around on their block anymore with other kids, you know, because they're afraid of going into other households. And if the parents don't like each other, then the kids can't play together. So I think that's more a thing that has occurred in the last 50 years that we feel, you know, it's interesting that a stay-at-home 50s mom spent the same amount of time with her kid as today, a full-time working mom does, because in that era we more had this idea that the children could run around on their bikes all day with other kids, not even be seen by another adult till 6 p.m.
Right.
Now parents are afraid to do that. So I don't think it's about solely comes down to marriage. It comes down, I think, to the insulation and the tribal of people living alone in cities, these nuclear families, one stacked against the other. When there isn't a sense of community and neighborhood, ideally the children, it should take a village, should be raised, you know, by groups of families and kin and, you know, rather than one nuclear family competing against the other nuclear family for their kids to get into the one spot left in college.
Caitlin, I want to get you on the social implications. Let me get one more call here first from Columbia, South Carolina. Heather. Heather, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Pretty good. What do you know?
First, I have 2 points. And being from Columbia, South Carolina, I'm unique in that I think Mark Sanford should go to Argentina and be with his love.
Yes.
If he has to fall back in love with his wife, Jenny should just say, "I forget it." And
yeah.
I am happily married, so it's not like I'm, you know. But I'm unique in that. I've talked to my friends about that since this broke, and I'm the only one who believes that.
Because you don't think it's worth staying together if the passion's not there or if the passion's gone elsewhere?
It's a slap in the face. I mean, to Jenny.
Oh,
Jenny is a high-powered woman. And also, I mean, why should Sanford sit on TV crying about the love of his life? I mean, he's young. Go for it. That's what I think. But
yeah, because it's a sham to go back. Yes.
Exactly. It's such a sham. And personally, a lot of people in South Carolina don't even care about his political life because he doesn't really do much for us. So we're not really I mean, you know, we're not really worried about that. But my second point is that I am married and I do have a child. And I was recently out in a bar. I'm in my 30s. Mm. And a man came up to me, and when he found out I was married and that I had a child, he wanted to know why I was at the bar, why I wasn't at home, and that I was there on false pretenses. And I just think that women, even though we're married, happily so, we still need our own identity. And I also come from a childhood, much like Sandra's, where I begged my mom to leave, and when she finally did, I was very excited about it.
Mm.
But we have to maintain our own identity for our children, because they grow up, and then where are we?
Heather, you put a lot of good stuff out there. Caitlin Flanagan, let me come to you. First, we've got John in Fort Myers saying, you know, for the society, we need marriage. Heather That's saying, don't true. Forget women's own identity. And if Governor Sanford's in love with somebody in Argentina, let him go there.
Well, society does need marriage, absolutely. For, you know, when you look at that huge number of births to unwed women in America, it's the CDC just brought the numbers out last month. It's 39.6%. I mean, this is, you
of
know,
children out of wed, born out of wedlock.
Born out of wedlock.
It's pretty amazing.
And it's an astounding number. And, you know, the New York Times and a lot of, you know, media, you know, the old saying in journalism is that news is what happens to your editor's friends.
Yeah.
And so you'll read a lot of stories saying, well, this is all about these single mothers by choice with Chinese babies in Park Slope. You know, what a big trend story. No, these are poor girls. They can't find any other way to adulthood. They have none of mm-hmm. the access to just, as a middle-class kid in America, that things that were assumed. I would graduate from high school. I would go to college. I would have a job that was connected to my education. All of those things that were I was gunning for obviously came before procreation. These girls, they want to do what I wanted to do. They want to get started in the business of being an adult. They can't. They're not having these babies to get a welfare check. That's a nasty, evil, conservative thing. They're not to say, and they're not having these babies so they can have a little doll to dress up.
But they're not getting married either.
Right, because they can't. To them, they've got the whole system all jumbled up in their minds. They certainly aren't going to get married at 14 to someone who's 22. A lot of times they want an older guy because they were raised without a dad in the home. They're very attracted to older men. And they don't, the whole natural sequence that leads to being married, they can't see it at 14, but they can see getting that baby. And that's a huge tragedy. And if we could do one thing in the American underclass, it would be to convince these young kids to not have a child until, A, they've graduated from high school, B, they've turned 18, and C, they've gotten married.
But Mark Sanford has a job, governor of South Carolina.
First we wanted to deal with the caller from Fort Myers, whom I think, Sandra, I think he said you had jilted you. I think he meant jaded, right?
Yes, I think jaded.
Okay.
Yeah,
or gilded. Gilded. Yes. And he's not wrong about
Yeah, he was
that.
Wrong about having a jilted view, but maybe a jaded view. But so let's be fair and clear that, yes, society will absolutely take an enormous step forward if we could get people in the underclass to start marrying. And we're not going to be that wounded in a deep, profound sense if people in the upper classes start divorcing. There's a sleeper effect to divorce.
They do plenty already, right? But even
right,
so,
that, you know, if you're going to look at marriage from bloodless economic terms, certainly marriage aggregates wealth. There's no question about it. What do middle-class Americans have? Where does their wealth sit? It sits in two places, their mortgages and their retirement accounts. Even in today's world, that's where it sits, and you start splitting that up, and you divide resources. So that's that. Now, for this lady in South Carolina, I definitely think she should have her own identity. I don't know if she needs to discover it at the bar. She's sort of saying, like, I need my own identity, so I got to go hang out at the bar. I don't know what that was about.
Well, we don't know if her husband was there. Maybe there at the bar. Maybe she, but to Sandra's perspective, maybe she wants to be at the bar.
Maybe she wants to have a beer.
I want to get one more call. Richard in Newton, Massachusetts. Richard, you're on the air.
Hello. Hi. I'm a psychiatrist. I've been a family therapist for 35 years. I'm writing a book called Marriages for Men and Divorces for Women, because it's pretty clear 70% of divorces are filed by women.
Yes,
and
true.
The majority of divorces were filed by women even before women got the vote in the United States.
Why? Why is
this? Well, that was because of the temperance movement.
But I guess, Richard, why do you say the reason why?
The reason why is, first of all, men and women start from very different places in terms of our relationship to our mothers, whether we expect to grow up and have a mother. Many men see their wife as mother 2.0, and many women can't really get past the disappointment that their husband isn't as good a mother as they had. But what I have found in my practice is that men and women characteristically don't understand each other, and what we are actually people want in their marriage is someone who understands them. And very often people will withhold understanding from the other person until they feel the other person understands them. So if marriage starts off with a romantic idealization, it will founder on the next kind of stage, which is mirroring, can you understand each other or not?
And if you can't, the door's open and maybe out you go. Richard, let us know when you get that book finished. We're still interested. Our time is short. Sandra, what do you say? Were you looking for a better mother in your husband?
that my mind is so blown that now I don't know. Now I don't know what to
think. Better run back.
You told a caller he couldn't finish his call till he finished his book.
Well, I'm sorry. I got 1 minute. You know, it doesn't fit a book.
I think that he's right. And married men do live. I mean, there are health benefits for men who are married, but not health benefits for women who are married. So I do think that women still have more to do in the marriage of keeping it going. And men, if they just cook a meal like once a week, they're viewed as an amazing dad. Again, my women complain, even if it takes 5 hours to make something that would have taken her 1 hour to, he still gets more credit. So I think men still have a somewhat better deal.
You know, we're not going to get to finish this today, but I'm so grateful to the two of you, friends, old friends, for coming on. Sandra Singlow, for your honesty, and Caitlin Flanagan, for your honesty and openness to the whole conversation here, defending marriage as Sandra walks away from hers. It's been really fascinating. I want to thank you each. Caitlin Flanagan, author of To Hell With All That. Caitlin, thanks for joining us today from L.A.
Thank you.
And Sandra Singlow, it's always great to talk with you, author of Mother on Fire, and if you lived here, you'd be home by now. Thank you very much for being here, Sandra.
Thanks for having us on, Tom.
Thanks for the essay. Really interesting. Listeners, thanks for joining us. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.